Welcome to Truth Talk with Myron.
Welcome to Truth Talk. Today, we're going to be discussing the family crisis part two as we take a look at the role of the man, the role of a woman, and what's missing from the family unit today. With us today, we're going to have Miss Amy Bendis, the author of Sailing the Seven Seas of Marriage and Educator, and Mr. Brett Sparks from the National Institute of Marriage. We want to welcome you both. Let's take a moment to meet our guests. Mr. Sparks, how are you doing today?
I'm well, Myron, thank you.
And Ms. Bendis, welcome.
Thank you very much.
All right. We'll start with you today, Mr. Sparks. Talk to us a little bit about your profession and your expertise, sir.
Well, Myron, I'm a licensed clinical psychologist, and actually that's kind of misleading a bit because my specialty today is working with marriages and particularly with couples in crisis. So I spend my day-to-day helping couples whose marriages are in bad places. Often they have divorce papers on the tables, and so I try to help them rebuild and recover for whatever damage or hurt or pain has been there. So that's pretty much how I spend my life most of the time.
Okay. Okay, and Ms. Bendis, talk to us a little bit about your career and your books, please.
Certainly. For over 17, almost 20 years, I was an educational administration professional in the public school district here in Green Bay, and I could see the effects that marriages that were not strong, that were in crisis, had on the children, and it just really inspires me to delve more deeply into the topic. My own marriage, it was, a good marriage up until year 9, but I knew that there was something missing. I knew it could be better. So, again, I poured myself into realizing what that could be, how to turn it around. I've led Bible studies on the topic, and one of those Bible studies turned into the first book, Sailing the Seven Seas of Marriage, almost finished with the second one, which will be a daily devotional for couples.
Okay. Well, today, as we want to talk about the family crisis, and when we talk about the family crisis today, this is going to be our second segment. We're going to do a five-part series, and if you guys want to join the conversation today, feel free to call in at 1-888-627-6008. If you want to add your input to the conversation. Last week, we talked a little bit about, we got a little brief overview of what was wrong with the families today in America. And we're going to dive a little bit more into it today. And I wanted to ask you, Mr. Sparks, first of all, do you see that there's a real problem in families today in America?
I do. I believe, in terms of what I see day to day, and then of course what I read on a little bit more of a global or national scale, I do believe that the most recent information I've seen around marriages is that people are more and more choosing not to marry or delay it further and further, and choose alternative ways of living together and having their what you would call their intimate relationships with one another, which then affects the whole. It affects the children. It affects everything at that point. So yes, I do. I see a crisis, and I also see I see others kind of saying that and making the case that that's occurring in our country.
Okay. Ms. Bendis, do you see it a crisis as well?
I do. You look at the divorce rates now, with 50% of the population getting a divorce, 33% of all Christian marriages falling apart. That's on the low end. We are not role models anymore for what God intended marriage to be, for what a good marriage has the potential of being. So if we can't lay the foundation for this wonderful gift and entice people and inspire people to go into marriages and to have a good marriage, then there's really nothing in it for them. They are turning to other alternative ways of being a couple, of being together, which is a detriment to society.
Okay. Let's take a look closer look at that. When we speak of marriages, let's pay attention, I guess, to that. I want to reference 1 Corinthians 7, 1 through 5 here, as the passage that led me to this is where in the Bible he says, you know, I'm reading from the ESV version, mm-hmm. to where he says, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, but because the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer. But then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." So I use that to substantiate this question. Mr. Sparks, by God's standards, should anyone who is a father first be a husband?
You bet. I believe that firmly, that it's God's design. I think you can even take it back, Myron, all the way to Genesis, where when we see the creation of human beings, that the marriage relationship precedes anything else, and it's that initial creation followed by the family and the being fruitful and multiplying that occurs. And so I think very much so that God's standard is that we would be husband, father, husband before father, and that relationship of husband and wife would be very important and needs to be fostered. Now, I do know that obviously we're living in a time when the opposite is happening. So I think the most recent, one of the things has come to my attention is that for the first time, I believe it was early last year, for the first time under at least women under the age of 30, over 50% of the children are being born out of wedlock. And so we know that we're, again, back to the crisis that you were mentioning, we're facing that today, but I think that's far from God's standard.
Okay. Ms. Bendis, do you have anything you want to add to that?
I would agree. Paul clearly states that, listen, buddy, if you do enter into this marriage relationship, you will need to focus on your wife. You will need to love your wife. And then, marriage was made for the procreation of children. But, if you can resist temptation, it's much better to remain unmarried because you can focus more on God. You can do His work. But if you burn with passion, if you can't control yourself, you need to enter into that marriage relationship with one woman, be committed to her, build a strong marriage, and then from that foundation build a strong family.
Okay, so then let us say then that it should be, being a responsible father means that a man should be a good husband first, which means he must love, honor, and nourish and cherish his wife. Is that right?
Absolutely.
That would be the ideal, yes.
Okay. Well, then, that being said and that being the case, I'm going to ask you, Mr. Sparks, since we know that things have changed a little bit, we're focusing on the role of the man in the family. Has a man's role changed in our culture today, as far as the family unit goes?
you know, I'm not sure, Myron, in terms of I'm sure there are probably different ways we would try to look at that. I've understood some things that it's still crucial and important, even for the marital relationship, for some of the traditional roles to be in place. Yet I think there's also it's clear that there is less of an emphasis on the husband being a breadwinner or the primary breadwinner anyways today, and yet it seems that that's still valued, that the husband would still earn something, but there's that less of that focus on the husband being the sole provider for the home. So I do see that taking place, and in terms of what that then means for men as fathers, I'm not fully sure what the end ramifications are of that, except for that become, you know, it doesn't get passed on, then some kind of value in that doesn't get passed on to his sons or even his daughters who are looking up to him as a father. So I'd like to I think there is a way in which sometimes the father gets portrayed very poorly at times in the media and different things, and yet at the same time I'm very aware, at least in what I see many times in the church and in different places, there's been an awakening to the importance of a father. So I don't know if we're kind of split, maybe like we are politically in this country, but there seems mm-hmm. to be a value to dads on the one hand, and then there seems to be a devaluing at other times. So I guess I need a long-winded answer to say I'm not sure if the role has fully changed, but it seems like there's been some attacks to fatherhood, at least along the ways. So
okay, we're going to take a break. Just to mention to you guys, to everyone, that in the second hour we'll have with us United States Senator Michael D. Brown. We'll be right back after break.
Levy's Furnitures, the best place for all your furniture.
Quality furniture from top manufacturers such as G-Plan, Stag, Ducal, Parker Knoll at prices never to be repeated. Levy's have an excellent reputation, so don't miss out. Get down to Levy's, 488 Cheetham Hill Road, Cheetham Village, Manchester. Large car park opposite. Sale now on.
Don't miss out. Get down to Levy's Furnitures.
Looking, looking local, looking, looking local, a magazine in which to be seen.
Looking Local is a great new free magazine, packed full of events, competitions and features. It's delivered to 25,000 homes and businesses in your area. If you haven't had your copy, call us now on Mansfield 443 777 or check out our website www.lookinlocal.co.uk. Looking Local, advertising that works.
Okay, we talked about the family crisis. We had some statistics that showed us that there were a large number, I believe, over 40% of kids being born here in the United States to single parents. And what I wanted to ask is the fact that in many homes, you can tell with the absence, basically, of a father, that children have, in some ways, been provoked to wrath. In some cases, a mother has chosen a lifestyle that precludes a father, sometimes for selfish reasons, but mostly is due to neglect, I think, or irresponsibility or selfishness of a father. And I want to ask you, again, I'm going to direct this to you, Mr. Sparks, to answer it first, and then you follow up, Ms. Bendis. Have fathers abandoned the responsibility to bring up children in the training and admonition of the Lord?
Well, I guess, Myron, as I hear the question, I think about it overall. I think there's obviously a crisis in our country in terms of absent fathers, And yet, I don't know the numbers for the church itself. And that's where the idea around training up, bringing up in a training and admonition of the Lord would certainly be for those homes that are dedicated and devoted to the Lord. And so I would imagine that you're probably right that in some cases there are going to be those dads who are abandoning for whatever reasons. You know, maybe they just don't know how to do it. They didn't see it from their dad, and they abandon it. And yet again, I see, and I don't know whether I'm not a historian, but I know with the movement, the Promise Keepers movement that took place, and even some of the there's some fatherhood initiatives that now I see a lot more men who are trying to take seriously the role of dad. There's a lot more to get educated. And there's even more information just to know whether you're alone or not, whether you're struggling with some of those things. So I would imagine, yes, I know that there are fathers that are abandoning that role and that place of being spiritual leader and those types of things in their home. But also, I know that there's others who are taking it very seriously today. And I don't know whether that'll affect culturally, that'll affect, but in the church, I do see a lot of that. I see a battle, maybe if that's the right word to use, for fatherhood and becoming better dads today.
Okay. We have with us Tina on line three. Tina, welcome to the show. You have a question for us?
Yes, I do. I was wondering if you could address the very topical question of, with all families and parents and children having digital equipment, you know, phones, internet, et cetera, how do we bring the family together with all this equipment out there that distracts them?
Can I address that issue? Because I've got two teenage boys. I know this very well, but I think we've got to go back. First of all, Myron, too, has a man's role changed in the family? And let me take 20 seconds to say emphatically, no, it has not changed. The role of the husband, the role of the father for 2,000 years is to be the spiritual and physical leader of the home. He's charged by God to do that, to bring up his children, to cherish his wife. That is his role. And as women have taken on more power in society, we've kind of overstepped our husbands and our fathers' role in the family, and we must let them lead. We must let them do this. That is their role. We must support them in that role. To your question, then, of digitally being distant as a family now, we need to have our children put those down. You can't have a TV in a child's bedroom. You cannot have them have their phone plugged in their bedroom. You have to create that family time when you are talking. You have to have them be with you, have eye contact, have face-to-face time in order to build those relationships. And I think both mothers and especially fathers have not taken that role seriously in today's society. We don't build the relationships. We don't schedule time with our kids. So our kids default back to where they're getting that attention, and that is the iPads, the iPhones, the cell phones, what have you. That's where they're getting attention because we're not providing it to them.
I think that's very profound.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. To follow up a little bit with both of your answers, when you say the father's role or man's role has not changed, and you mentioned Mr. Sparks out there is a battle, I do agree. But the topic always seems to fall back into to marriage. But as I spoke last week, by a lot of people's standards, the ideology of marriage has changed. You know, the concept or the foundation of marriage has changed. Do you guys agree with that, or they're trying to change it?
They're trying to change it, exactly. The world, because we are so connected to each other now, more and more people have ideas on what marriage should be and how you should be free and how you should get your own needs met. But Myron, marriage has not changed. God's intention for marriage has not changed. his definition of what a husband, what a father, what a wife, what a mother has not changed. Society would want it to change so that we can get our needs met and be self-fulfilled and self-gratified, but the foundation has not changed.
Thank
I would agree totally with that. Yeah, I agree. There is no doubt a cultural battle, and marriage is at risk, at least the foundational way in which it's been viewed, and of course that's God's way. And as God drifts from our culture, it makes sense then that he drifts, and his ways of viewing marriage and things drift. And I guess we as a church have the opportunity to try to hang on with dear life. And, you know, I think the truly hard part for us here in America is that we face the potential for persecution if we try to hang on to what we believe is God's standard. And that's, you know, I think overall some of us in this country obviously have, but many of us have not. And it's frightening to think of that. And yet, at the end of the day, there's reasons why God set marriage up as he did, why it's one woman, one man, why it precedes childbearing and all those things. There's reasons, good reasons, for that. And it's interesting to see social science is discovering a lot of ill effects of marriages being in crisis, as well as then absence of fathers. There's just so many factors that get affected, from the children to even the well-being of the husband and wife and the mother and father. So.
That's so true. And Myron, you said before, you mentioned a statistic, 40% of kids born to single parents, you know, is that wrath now being displayed in our children. You bet it is. Kids know. They know from early on that they need a father. They need a mother to be active in their lives. And when that's not there, does that tick them off? You bet it does. And they are angry. And I've worked with a lot of angry children that when you get right down to it and they break down crying in your office because, you know, I just wish I had that connection. I wish I had that role model. They are so vulnerable and they are so desperately wanting us to be that role model that God intended us to be.
Okay, I agree with that, but you said, Mr. Sparks, like you said, let's examine real quickly. You stated there's a battle, it's a war. Well, the war is between society and the church and the politicians or the government and the church, would you say? And then also to add to that, the caller addressed an issue, two different questions, but she mentioned, you know, the digital age. And as you answered that, Ms. Bendis, you stated, you know, the kids turn to that because their parents do not take time. Well, is accountability missing from families as well? So, Mr. Sparks, back up a little bit. You want to address the first question?
Around accountability, Myron?
No, sir. Around, are we at war? You know, if the church stand up for the true foundation or people stand on the true foundation of what marriage is, it's a battle between government and society.
Yeah, I guess if we take Paul's word seriously, we know the battle is really between there's a spiritual battle at play, it's playing out then, of course, in our culture. Obviously, we're seeing it in all these different venues, from the entertainment, the media, the digital stuff, all the flood of information, and then politically, culturally. Yeah, so I think so. I think there's definitely an attack, and it seems that it's easier today to be able to verbalize your disagreement with God or the way, you know, the quote unquote Christian underpinnings of our society. So yes, I think there's definitely a spiritual battle at play.
Okay, Ms. Bendis, accountability.
Jesus told us in Matthew 12:36 that we will be accountable on the day of judgment for every careless word we have spoken, for every act we have done. But I think today accountability is more to ourselves. And if it feels good, do it. If it makes sense for us at the time to fulfill our selfish nature, do it. And we are more accountable to ourselves than to God or to a higher being or to an authority. And Paul warns us in Romans, Paul warns us in Hebrews, that we will be accountable to God in the end. And you know what? That's a hard thing to think about. Boy, every decision I make can't be about me and what I need. It's got to be about a sacrifice and serving others. And we don't want to face that because, you know what? We can't always do what we want to do when we face that reality. So is accountability missing? Yeah, I think it's shifted from a higher authority to the self, and it needs to shift back.
I agree. Unfortunately, I'm out of time on this matter, and I couldn't get to all of the questions I wanted to discuss today, but I hope that what we have covered will help someone and is educational for those. After break, we'll have with us Senator Michael Brown. Mr. Sparks, I want to thank you for your time today as well. Good luck to you in all your endeavors and everything that you do. And Ms. Bendis, are you staying with us? Or?
Yes, I will. Thanks, Myron.
All right. We're glad to have you. We'll see you guys after break.
You're listening to The Corbett Report. CorbettReport.com.
Welcome, my friends. Welcome to another edition of The Corbett Report. I'm your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you, as always, from the currently drizzly climes of Western Japan here on this first day of March 2013. Welcome to episode 260 of The Corbett Report podcast, Globalists Hate C-SPAN. Lamentably, it is a sad truism that many of us out there, even us, the strong, the few, the Hyperboreans, the Corbettians of the alternative media sphere, can fall victim to the most blatant globalist propaganda, particularly that propaganda which seeks to convince us that those around us in the general public don't understand what's happening, they can't identify the globalists, and that they are utterly and totally 100% buying into the globalist propaganda. Now, that is, in fact, demonstrably wrong, but it is something that all of us fall victim to believing every now and then because it is so constantly drilled into us and programmed into us from a lot of different sources, but primarily, I would say, through the media that we consume on a daily basis. And this type of programming, this propaganda that seeks to convince us that, in fact, no one understands what's happening except us, it really does work against us so very, very well because it gets a lot of people to start fighting with each other rather than fighting against the globalist forces that are seeking to puppeteer our society. And we see this reflected even in the type of language that gets bandied about, even in the alternative media, calling the vast majority of the population sheeple and saying that they're blind zombies and spending most of our time lamenting that fact rather than trying to actually disseminate real information. And this is important because it is part of a divide and conquer strategy. It is getting us to blame the victims for their own victimization rather than actually doing something useful in stopping that victimization from occurring in the first place. So how do we go about undermining that programming? Well, first, let's just take a look just one example of how this programming occurs. As I say, this tends to occur most obviously in the media sphere, and perhaps most obviously of all of those examples in the medium of television, which is that perfect medium that the globalists have devised for basically injecting ideas and cultural memes directly into our subconscious. And there are a lot of studies and a lot of things to talk about in regard to that, and perhaps we will have an episode in the future examining television as a medium. But at any rate, let's just take an example from that example par excellence of predictive programming and media programming and globalist propaganda and all things related to these subjects, and that would be Fareed Zakaria's GPS on CNN. And you could basically spin a wheel and land on any single episode of this series and come up with a pretty good example of the phenomenon that we're talking about.
And welcome back. With us at this time, we are glad to have with us United States Senator Michael Brown. He was elected in 2006 with 84% of the vote, and he serves the people of the District of Columbia as an advocate for statehood and equal rights. Senator Brown, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Myron. I'm happy to be on.
We're glad to have you, sir. Also with us, we still have Ms. Amy Bendis. She is the an author and an educator.
That's right.
Hi, Amy. And,
I wanted to start with you, sir, to ask you, what is your role in the Senate, and how are you able to represent citizens on federal issues, sir?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, I don't have a role in the United States Senate. I am elected by the people of the District of Columbia, like all other senators. Actually, in November, I got 207,000 votes, which is more than six other United States senators. But I'm not allowed to serve. My title is United States Senator, but I actually represent the people of the District of Columbia as a lobbyist to get them equal rights, since they have no vote in either the Senate or the House of Representatives. We also lack control of our own budget and our legal system in the District of Columbia. We're completely controlled by the federal government. So my job is to do whatever I can to try to secure equal rights for the people of the District of Columbia, and that's what I do.
Okay. Okay. To add to that, what is the culture like now in D.C.? I mean, how has it changed?
Well, the culture is very partisan. I think you can see that over this whole battle for sequester right now. It's more divided now than I've ever seen it. Let me say that I spent 35 years in national politics before being elected to the office of United States Senator. I had worked on many political campaigns and had been a staffer at the Democratic National Committee and have done a lot of things in Washington. And I've never seen the culture as divided as it is right now. I mean, if you look at the sequester picture that we've got going on right now, you just had financial reports come out. The Dow Jones Industrial has hit an all-time record high on Friday. We've got housing prices surging at a six-year high level, and we have unemployment dropping to an all-time low for the past 5 years, and yet we're fighting over the sequester in Congress, and we're about to throw a hand grenade into the economy because we can't come to an agreement. So I think that pretty much says it all about how divided we are.
Right. Well, do you agree with the president's demands to Republicans to replace the cuts with a blend of targeted tax cuts? Cuts and tax hikes, because he was unable to halt the $85 billion in the physical spending cuts to take effect?
Absolutely.
Because of the sequester?
Absolutely. We have to. We can't just, this is not just a matter of cutting expenses. What we're doing here is we're cutting everything across the board. So just think of it on your own terms. If, for example, you were going through personal economic hard times, you lost your job or something, it's not like you're saying, well, we're going to cut out going out to dinner and we're going to cut out the movies. What you're saying is we're going to cut 10%. We're only going to send in 90% of our mortgage. We're only going to send in 90% of our utility bills. We're only going to feed the kids 6 days a week. I mean, it's cut across the board. And this is the absolute worst time to go into our economy with a machete and just start hacking things up. It's time for us to take a close look. We can't continue to add to the debt. Everybody agrees with that. But we have to take a realistic look at what the cuts are, and they have to include tax hikes as well. So I think the president's absolutely right in asking the Republicans to do this.
Well, I mean, didn't the House Republicans propose legislation to keep the government running, it would freeze salary rates for some federal employees but mitigate on the impacts of the deep government-wide spending cuts known as the sequester? I mean, wasn't that a fair resolution?
That wasn't a fair resolution. All that did was put the problem off for another day. And now that day has come, and these people, the same people, are balking at making a reasonable resolution. You know, what we need is we need smart reforms. We don't need mindless cuts. And that's what we're talking about with the sequester. So they attempted to push the ball back in the president's court, but it's come now. The president has tried to reach out, I think, to Republicans in Congress, and now the ball is in their court, and they need to step up and act.
Okay, well, who's at fault? Which party's at fault, would you say, for us to even be in this position for sequestering?
Well, I think both parties are at fault to be in this position. You know, I don't think that you could, I don't think you find yourself in this economic position without both parties taking some blame for this. Obviously, we've overspent on certain entitlement programs that need to be reined in. But mm-hmm. also, we need tax hikes and other reasonable cuts that make this all work. You know, Myron, there used to be a thing called being an American when I was growing mm-hmm. up, you know, that people put aside their differences for the good of the country. And I think we've lost a lot of that. I think the partisanship and the rancor that we have in the District of Columbia right now in Congress has overshadowed the fact that sometimes we all need to suck it up for the good of the country. And I think that's what needs to be done here. I mean, I don't think that anybody should be standing up there pointing a finger at anybody. I think mm-hmm. they need to come together, and we need to resolve this issue by putting forth a plan of targeted cuts and targeted tax increases.
Okay. Ms. Bentis, do you want to jump in here a little bit? What are your thoughts?
Certainly. Thanks for the opportunity. We had talked earlier, Myron, about a father, a husband, stepping up and sucking it up, if you will, and taking a lead role in the family. I think that in America today, we are all looking for, okay, what can I get out of government? What's in it for me? And, Senator, you talked about how we have overspent on entitlement programs. We have got people looking for handouts. We have got them not taking leadership roles today. Yes, we have to have people less dependent on government so that we can feel that sense of pride of accomplishment and leadership. We need to teach men to fish instead of just handing out fish. So I think that we do need to cut back on government, like you say, cut back on the entitlement programs, like you say, so that our citizens can become Americans again and take that leadership role that we were so proud of years ago.
Well, I agree, and the only thing that I would add to that is that we have to understand that entitlements go both ways, and they not only go to the poor and the old and the young, they go to the wealthy, and the wealthy are still looking for their entitlements, and they have to be brought into the picture, and that's a big problem with what's going on right now, is that these guys on Capitol Hill are trying to protect their base. And their base are wealthy people that don't want to give. So when we take from poor people,
Senator, can you define wealth for me? What makes a person wealthy? Where is the line of wealthy?
Well, certainly people that make over $250,000 a year, I think, are considered wealthy in America. And these are people that the Republicans are trying to protect.
Well, and I don't think we can lump everybody together because there are a lot of wealthy Americans that do give to charities that, of course, tithe to their churches that do keep America running, so to speak. So, you know, to make broad brush strokes to, you know, categories of people is very detrimental, I think.
Well, I'm not chastising wealthy people. I think that there's a place, we're a big tent, and there's a place for everybody in America. And this isn't about wealthy people, but it's about Republicans trying to protect their interests on Capitol Hill. It's not about, I'm not suggesting that wealthy people are behind this. I'm suggesting that Republicans are attempting to protect their base, and they're also attempting to attack the president.
But what about Democrats trying to protect their base of the dependent people in America and keeping them dependent on government.
Well, I don't know what specific programs you're talking about as far as keeping people dependent, okay, because college loans and school lunch programs for children and Social Security are not keeping people dependent. And those are the
right, and I'm talking about those three. But Myron, it's your show. What do you want to say?
Yeah,
well,
please, Myron.
Let me interject here. I'm not going to jump on you, but you did mention wealth, and I think that's a great point to point out wealth. And I want to ask you, Senator, in your own words, to define something for me.
Yeah.
You stated, like you say, okay, well, the Republicans want to attack or protect their base. Okay, well, one thing that what you're talking about is class warfare, right? Well, when we take a look at Washington, D.C. within itself, you have allocation of federal dollars there, but that's taxpayer money. That money, when you look at the boom in Washington, D.C. itself, it's not about a party. I mean, this is going to both bases, Republicans and Democrats. And Washington right now has the highest per capita income than anywhere else in the nation. So what is that picture? I mean, you know, when you have people that are struggling to find jobs, and like you say, you know, as is pointed out, you have people wanting handouts, you got entitlement programs, but yet you've got this great big boom in D.C. So is it fair to say that it's really not about Republicans or Democrats, but it's just the culture of Washington?
Well,
am
you
I
know,
wrong about
you,
that?
You do have the highest per capita income in the country in Washington, D.C. We also pay the highest per capita taxes, and I don't think it's a matter of rich and poor. What I'm saying is that you've got Republicans on Capitol Hill that are saying they want to cut entitlement programs, but they don't want to talk about tax increases. You can't have it just one way, and I think you're absolutely right. I think it affects everybody. This is going to affect rich and poor, and in fact, in our region, it's going to have a devastating impact on us because 15% of all the workers in our region are federal employees. So this will have a profound impact on us. And it's not that I think that what I'm saying is, yes, we have to cut entitlements, but, yes, we have to look at taxes. And as long as
I don't understand that. Why? I don't understand. Why can't you cut entitlements without having tax increases? I stepped away from a $100,000 a year job in order to pursue now strengthening marriages and families. So our family has had to, you know, cut what we do without more coming in and become leaner and meaner and empower ourselves. So I think the base of it is empowering the American base, you know, not a Democratic base, not a Republican base, but the American citizen base, not entitling them, empowering them to do something to contribute to society and not just take from society.
Well, I agree with you 100%. I would just add to that that it's a myth that we're a country of takers. We're not a country of takers, you know, and that's a myth that was put forth by the Republicans in the last election. We are a country of producers. You know, America is great because of our ability to produce and because of our ability to innovate and because of our ability to work hard, not because of our ability to put up fences and make restrictions and blame others. And that's what this idea that we are have become a nation of takers is. We're not a nation of takers. And
yeah,
so again, I would say cut entitlements, but don't keep people that make an inordinate amount of money out of the picture, and that's what they're trying to do.
We have a caller, Kathleen. You have a question for us, ma'am?
Well, yes, I do. I was listening to the conversation about entitlements, and I'm in a very kind of interesting situation. I've worked all my life, college education, raising two kids, the whole thing, and I got laid off of my job a year ago, and I find two things happening to me. I don't have a master's, because I thought, you know, just 4 years would be enough. And now I'm at a point where I'm kind of stuck in a very small town on the Mexican border. I'm looking to move. But right now, for the first time in my life, I never thought, I am on entitlement. And if that wasn't there for me in this time of need, I don't know what would happen to me or my kids. I mean, just anything. My son just broke his arm last week. Thank God I got onto the state health program. We had to go take an ambulance at $7,000 from Douglas to Tucson. If there weren't these entitlements, you know, people think that everyone is just out there saying, give me more, give me more. I don't want to work. Well, with the economy,
I can so identify with you. Yes, I can so identify with you. I've got a family member who was laid off, same type of thing. And I do believe that there is a time and a place that we need to help people for a brief time because they have fallen and they have come into hard times.
And it can't be something they rely on for life.
Right. And it can't be something that we rely on for life.
But let me
because
say this
there
one
are
thing,
jobs out
that
there
not,
that don't require a master's ma'am, degree that you can, you
not,
know,
not
sustain
at a
your
rate
family
in which
on.
I have to pay. Well, let me tell you this. When you're looking at, I got a kid in college, and an in-state Arizona University of Arizona is $40,000 a year, and he wants to be a doctor. I can't take a $20,000 job. I will be in the shelter, right? So the thing is that what I really get annoyed at, and let me say this one point, is that when people talk about people taking time, they have a perception if people haven't worked, they're using the system, they're milking the system, and yes, maybe they did 4 or 5 years ago, but let me tell you what I have to go through to get unemployment every week, what I have to go through to get insurance from the state because I don't have any, it is a full-time job, and it is very, very dehumanizing. So it's kind of that thing that people don't understand. I think there's a lot more of me right now in the United States than the guy in Bronx in the ghetto who's done this all his life. The other thing I want to talk about entitlement, what about the farm subsidies? What about all those when the senator was talking about entitlements? When you look at Microsoft, when you look at Apple, how much do they really pay in taxes? And that's where I think a balance has to come because I'm ready to go out there and work. I'm going to be moving in May to try to find a job that I can be able to live, at least pay my bills and send my kids to college. But I want the farm subsidies, like up in the Dakotas and, you know, going through Nebraska where it's just cornfield after cornfield after cornfield. Those guys are all getting subsidies. The windmill guys, they're all getting subsidies with their windmills on there. So, you know, that's the balance that doesn't take place because those guys in D.C. aren't in my position. They don't feel my pain. And let me tell you, they shouldn't be getting paid at all. If they, both sides, Democrats, Republicans, President and Congress, cannot sit down, figure out a budget, then let's not pay them. Let's let them stand in line at the airport, and then we'll talk about fairness because those guys don't get it.
Well, you know, I just want to tell you that this lady is a typical example, I think. Most entitlement programs are out there to help people on a temporary basis. And things like unemployment insurance, you know, they run out. Assistance to families, AFDIC, WIC, all these things are temporary programs. And there's a myth out there that there's people that just live off welfare and play the system. And there are some that do. But I guarantee you there are more people in the corporate world that play the system than there are poor people that play the system. And when we need to look at entitlements, she's absolutely right. We need to look at all the entitlements. I don't know if you guys have seen the headlines in the New York Times and the Washington Post about the corporate jet giveaway, where hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes are given away every year to people that own corporate jets. These are the types of things that we need to address, as well as addressing the regular entitlement programs like Social Security and programs to help the poor and the working poor. And that's the point. I mean, we all have to come together on this because it affects everybody in America.
I don't think God ever intended anyone to need to live off of anyone else. I really think that it goes back to his original plan for us with the blessings that we have as far as the resources he gives to us. When you get married as a husband and wife, which is the intentional plan, you blend your money. I've got an acronym in my book, Sailing the Seven Seas of Marriage, called BLESS. You blend your money, you lay out a plan, you enter evidence, you share opinions, and you serve others. The acronym of BLESS. And when you have resources, and blend and use those resources appropriately. Now, I don't know. We all fall into hard times. I'm there myself, can't take my kids to the doctor. I get that without a deductible, you know, having gone down a $100,000 income. I get it. I understand where you are. But I don't think God ever intended for us to be sufficient on anybody else. He wanted us to be self-sufficient, and we've gotten ourselves into quite a calamity in the United States today.
Well, I'm a Christian, so let me tell you that my God says that which you do unto the least of them, you do unto me.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that's
so
the
he
that's
believes
the
in taking
you
care
got
of the poor. He doesn't believe.
Absolutely.
He does. And a lot of people
that's the
see
S. That's
that.
That's to serve others, you bet.
Well, you can see it as a proclamation to serve others, or you can see it as a warning. That which you do unto the poor, you do unto him. And that's the way I see it. I see it as you need to be careful with the poorest members of society and the oldest members in society and the most fragile members of society as a Christian. Because God
expects
you. And
I guess where you see a warning, I see love. I see us needing to reach out and love to those people, not
well,
as a warning to what will happen if we don't. Yeah.
Well, we do need to reach out in love to those people, and it's an important priority. And that's not
right,
living off
others. Right, and to empower
others.
Them. Right, and to empower them to become self-sufficient. Absolutely.
Of course. And that's what
Senator,
many
I
of these programs are aimed at. None of these government programs are aimed at keeping people on welfare their whole lives. None of them. They're all
you
aimed at
earlier,
empowering people.
Senator Brown, that you can hear the frustration in the young lady's voice there, but you said earlier that it's a myth about people, you know, to a degree about people jumping on the entitlements. Well, here in Texas, I can tell you, you have a large abuse of the system. Now, I do agree, there are a lot of people that are in need, just like the young lady that called, that really do need it. But for years, you've had a lot of people that have abused the entitlement programs out there. They won't work. What I'm saying, I guess, in short, is that to ask you, what is the right strategy to solve this problem? Because you can't have, when you have people that have actually tried to go to school, get an education, and can't get a job, part of that lies on the administration that's in office right now, because it's unclear. That's the problem. There is no transparency there to where you have a lot of people who are frustrated because they can't find work. They don't want to be on entitlements, but they have no choice.
Well,
the administration hasn't created jobs, and then they attack the wealthy. But it's the wealthy, it's the wealthy people who are going to create the jobs. And when you're increasing budgets for entitlement, somebody has to pay for that. And 9 times out of 10, it's taxpayers that's paying
well,
for it.
Well, you're not looking at the numbers, Myron. That's it. The stock market's at an all-time high. I'm telling you right now, the stock market's at an all-time high. Unemployment is the lowest it's been in 5 years, and housing prices are higher than they've
been.
Not
by the numbers I see.
But unemployment for who, Senator?
I mean,
that's my point. Unemployment for who?
Unemployment is 7.7%.
But for
across
who?
Across the board,
I mean, it's high employment rate in Washington, D.C., but what about here in Texas?
No, that's not
unemployment
rate in Washington, D.C. That's the national unemployment rate.
I know in Wisconsin our government is closing our employment, our unemployment rate in Wisconsin. That's closing. National, it's still very high. There are different numbers out there depending on the ones that you're looking at.
Well, Senator, let me ask you, how do we fix it?
Unemployment rate released yesterday by the federal government. You know, we have 30% unemployment in the Anacostia section of Washington, D.C. I mean, there are pockets of severe unemployment, surely, around the United States. But nationally, unemployment is coming down. The stock market's going up. Housing starts are rising. Prices in housing are – the economy is recovering. And
Senator, this idea
that you're gonna ignore that in order to cut entitlements
no.
is the problem.
I'm sorry, we're about out of time here, I wish we could continue the conversation.
Yeah,
it's been
too.
Great. Senator, I really do appreciate you taking the time
to
be on the show.
And I appreciate you having me, Myron.
Ms. Bendis, I want to thank you for participating and for taking the time to do the show today. And
you're welcome. My pleasure.
We'll see you guys next time. Until then, be prayerful, be wise, and be adaptable. God bless you all.
It is, no subject is taboo. If it's brought to the table, you bet we cover it. No more lies, no more deception. You have a right to know. It's bold. It's informative. It's Truth Talk.